Hello, everyone. This is Sue Marks reading today from the Catholic Telegraph for October 2019. Being Pro-Life by Bob Wurzelbacher, Understanding and Combating Domestic Violence. Gloria was four when her father first started physically abusing her. As a young child, she often hid in her closet, afraid she might die, feeling like she was a bad person. She learned not to fight back or cry or scream too much, knowing if she did, the beatings would be worse for both her and her mother. She never told a teacher or grandparent for fear her father would kill her. Gloria was born to young parents, 15 and 17, who were also reared in dysfunctional families. Gloria chose not to leave, not only out of fear, but also to protect her younger siblings. Eventually, she got involved with a bad crowd in high school. One day, she went to a party where she was locked in a room and sexually assaulted. When her father found out, he responded with further physical abuse. Suspended from school, Gloria completed her GED, got a job, and moved out of the house at age 17. The abuse did not end there, however. Growing up in that environment with low self-esteem, she soon married a man who abused her. When she finally got out of that abusive situation, she walked right into another, then another. It is a difficult cycle to break. Why can't they just leave? There can be many reasons. Abusers are often controlling, both financially and socially, so a victim may not have access to financial means or a place to go. People who are abusive and manipulative are often charming and have people who will defend them in court. Most importantly, an abused person often fears for his or her life or the lives of their children. The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, that's NCADV, reports that one in four women and one in seven men have been victims of severe physical violence, beating, burning, strangling, by an intimate partner. Domestic violence hotlines in the United States receive more than 20,000 calls per day. It is a huge problem, and the Catholic Church recognizes it as such. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, USCCB, strongly condemns it and offered guidance for parishes in its 2002 document, When I Call for Help. The USCCB Secretariat of Pro-Life Activities also published a short but helpful document, Life Matters. You can download it for free as a flyer or bulletin insert for parishes from our website, www.catholiccincinnati.org/ministries-offices/respect-life-2. What can we do? I spoke with Dr. Sharon O'Brien, Director of Catholics for Family Peace, an education and research initiative from Catholic University of America, who also works closely with the USCCB to help Catholic clergy and lay leaders recognize domestic violence and respond with compassion. Dr. O'Brien mentions five things. One, pray for those affected by domestic abuse, including it in the prayers of the faithful. Number two, educate yourself on the issue. Watch the video, listen to the podcast, and download the USCCB bulletin inserts and brochures to show your parishioners. Three, believe someone if they tell you they are in an abuse situation and ask what you can do. Four, make people aware of the domestic violence website hotline at 800-799-SAFE. (7233 would be the numbers, the numerals. Number five, donate to the hotline just mentioned at www.thehotline.org. Catholics for Family Peace at www.catholicsforfamilypeace.org or to Catholic Charities or a local center. In addition to Gloria, I spoke with other victims of domestic violence who all shared their stories. Visit our website at www.catholiccincinnati.org/beingprolife to watch the video interviews, hear the full stories of each guest, and subscribe to the weekly podcasts. There you can also find all the links and downloads mentioned in this article. We will continue to help raise awareness of this issue, utilize in our parishes the free resources offered by the USCCB, and ensure people who feel trapped by domestic violence get the help they need to break free of their unsafe situations. Another segment, A Closer Look by Kenneth Craycraft. Dignity never been photographed. Each October, beginning on the first Sunday, the Church in the United States observes Respect Life Month. While of course we should embrace and applaud the celebration, I wonder how helpful abstract concepts like respecting life are in helping us to stand as witnesses against an encroaching culture of death. In fact, such abstractions may actually hinder our ability to know, first, how we learn to respect life, and second, what exactly we should respect. Individualist moral culture. First, to think about any moral issue in abstractions ill-equips us to learn the habits, practices, and virtues that make laudable concepts like respecting life intelligible. Of course, Catholics believe that moral principles are fixed and enduring, rooted as they are in the order of creation. And from these principles, we derive rules of conduct, including rules related to respecting human life. But knowing these principles and rules is often not very useful in helping us to keep them. As St. Paul wrote to the church at Rome, "What I do not understand, for I do not do what I want, but I do what I hate." This is because while moral rules are fixed in nature, we acquire moral knowledge in the concrete practices and habits of particular moral communities. As Catholics, we cannot properly learn what it means to respect life if our moral commitments are formed by the broad secular society in which most of us live our workday lives. Ours is an individualist moral culture that teaches that our lives are radically separate from the lives of others, that we are nothing more than isolated, rights-bearing individuals. As such, to respect life means to leave other lives alone as individuals pursue their own solitary preferences and secure their individual rights. In this story, to respect life is reduced to leaving me alone so I can do what I please. Unfortunately, this dominant story holds powerful sway over many of us Catholics, and it hinders us from learning the true habits and practices that lead us to have a proper respect for human lives. So while we know this is not a proper way to respect life, we often find our practices conforming to it. We do not do what we want, but what we hate. The moral community of the Church. This is very different from the moral community of the Church, formed by a vision of the dignity of the human person and the solidarity of all humankind. The Church is a moral community in which we learn that respecting life entails not indifference to the lives of others as they pursue their individual rights, but rather solicitude for others as we strive toward our common purpose of loving God and serving one another. This calls us not to live our lives isolated from others, but to be available to others. Respect the person. A second problem with the phrase respect life is that it tends to cause us to respect an idea rather than to respect human persons made in the image of God. We are not called to respect the abstract concept of life, but rather to respect the actual person whose life is a gift from God that only God may intend to take. To be made in the image of God means that we are endowed with inviolable dignity and our mandate to love other persons. To respect life is based in that dignity. But we do not respect the dignity. Rather, we respect the person to whom that dignity attaches and from whom it can never be taken. In his song, Dignity, Bob Dylan wrote, Somebody showed me a picture and I just had to laugh. Dignity never been photographed. His point is that we do not see dignity. Rather, we see persons whose dignity is unalienable. And it is those persons whom we are called to love, even when it is difficult to discern the dignity in their circumstances. But if we make the mistake of looking for dignity rather than the person who possesses it, we often will not see anything at all. This is because some lives do not look very dignified. But we love that person anyway because he or she is not the source of dignity. God is the source, and it is not ours to take from any person, no matter how undignified he may look. Dignity has never been photographed, nor has it ever been loved. People are to be loved because of the dignity that is a gift from God, and we are called to be formed by a community that learns to love them, even when we cannot see that dignity. I want to mention this really quickly. St. Boniface Thanksgiving Festival in Northside next Sunday. No, excuse me. It's Sunday, November 17th. 1 to 6 p.m., 4305 Pitts Street, Cincinnati, Ohio. And there's another festival prior to that, St. Martin of Tours Martin Fest, Saturday, November 9th, 6 p.m. to midnight. You must be 21 years or older. 3720 St. Martin's Place in Cheviot. So that's November 9th, Saturday, November 9th. St. Boniface Thanksgiving Festival. Wow. In Northside, Sunday, November 17th. Walking the Path of Devastation. Story and photos by Jessica Rinodo. Archbishop Dennis Schnur tours tornado damage in Dayton, meets with Catholic Social Services. It was a somber day walking into the offices of Catholic Social Services of the Miami Valley in Dayton. Archbishop Dennis Schnur was there to visit and hear the stories of CSSMV workers and volunteers who have spent every day since the May 28th tornado devastation helping victims get back on their feet. The room quickly filled with staff members who assist with everything from Federal Emergency Management Agency, that's FEMA applications, and long-term aid, to helping displaced expectant mothers. Despite their range of assistance efforts, their stories all shared a common theme. In devastation, there is help and hope. Story after story of victims were told through choked voices and tears. There was a family whose father and sole financial provider had suffered a stroke the day before the tornado hit. His wife and children were struggling with the financial ramifications of that tragedy, and had a giant tree sitting on top of their home and covering their yard. Families with 4 to 8 children struggled to find affordable, available, and large enough rental housing following the scarcity and elevated prices of the market after the tornado. If families were lucky enough to find a rental, application fees for the space quickly became something families could not manage. Many lost everything, their home, their place of work, income, vehicle, furniture, even things as small and crucial as pots and pans. The needs of victims varied, but CSSMV was there to help. That's Catholic Social Services of Miami Valley. Megan Gottemuller is a community health navigator for CSSMV. Although a primary part of her normal day-to-day job is helping expectant mothers and mothers with infants, her work quickly expanded in the wake of the tornado destruction. She began taking phone calls from people who had no place to go. She was working to house them at a local motel where CSSMV received a welcomed phone call. Immediately after the tornado, the University of Dayton called us, and they wanted to do something to help. Since it happened in the summer, the students were not on campus, so they generously offered campus housing to families that were displaced that we were working with, said Gottemuller. So we had a family from Kaiser Elementary School, families from our parenting program. We had some families that we had connected with through St. Vincent de Paul locally that University of Dayton agreed to assist with housing, and we agreed to assist with case management. That relationship provided housing for families for about 4 weeks, desperately needed time to make action plans for their future. Tamara Gaddis Strozier initially joined CSSMV to help with short-term relief, but has since been hired as the recovery navigator to help with ongoing cases. A lot of people are able to take care of themselves if they can just get a good start, said Gaddis Strozier. They're not looking for a handout, they just need that first piece, and then they can manage on their own. She added that another area of the population who are struggling in the aftermath of the tornado are the elderly. In some cases, dementia and being in an unfamiliar environment following the tornado have caused greater problems. Seniors are a very vulnerable people who have been affected here, said Laura Roche, Chief Executive Officer for CSSMV. It was a particularly cruel path that the tornado took. Communities that were already struggling were hit very hard. Many avoided seeking help after the natural disaster, either believing they wouldn't qualify for assistance or because they were ashamed to ask for aid. Being able to come to a place where you can still have your dignity after having to seek help is important, said Roche. All agreed that the community of Dayton and the outpouring of support they have shown for their fellow neighbors has been incredible. Even FEMA, that comes in town, has shared stories that the response they've seen in Dayton is like anything they've seen in communities they worked with, said Mary Reed, Director of Social Services Dayton. That's their job, to go to communities and help people and help them pick up, and they are so blown away by how quickly our community has mobilized and the generosity of community. The support we have received from the Archdiocese and the churches personally blew me away. When we found out that you, Archbishop Schnur, had suggested a second collection, what we received was way over what we thought we would receive, said Mike Lehner, Director of Marketing and Development for CSSMV. In response to those stories of devastation and assistance, Archbishop Schnur said to the group, "It speaks volumes that people here have taken on extra responsibilities and clientele just to be able to help. Listening to the stories, this isn't a job you're really getting into the people's lives, and you're hurting with them for them. To educate them on the various opportunities with FEMA in particular that they're overlooking. I think you're doing a fantastic job, and thank you for that. We love our staff all the time, but we're extra loving them and this group in particular because of the way they have stepped up, working together and developing and sharing and supporting each other," responded Roche. "Many of us have people who we knew who were personally impacted or our families. This is definitely a community issue." Following the listening session, Archbishop Schnur traveled around the Dayton community to seeing the damage firsthand, bearing witness to the discovery efforts and praying downtown at the site of the Dayton mass shooting, which was less than 2 weeks old at the time. "Rolling through the streets of Dayton was a gut punch. Pristine houses and businesses sat next to homes that had been reduced to rubble. At times, the only recovery work people could do was to clear their lots and start anew. Trees lay in piles of snapped branches, roots exposed, while blue tarps dotted the horizon. The echo of hammers traveled across the otherwise quiet landscape. As Archbishop Schnur stepped out of the vehicle in one of the hardest-hit neighborhoods, Roche and Gaddis Rozier stood next to him, sharing stories of devastation and long-term recovery efforts. Part of the visit also included a stop at Kaiser Elementary School in Old North Dayton, where many of the students affected by the tornado attend. Faculty and staff met with the Archbishop to share how they are helping students in the aftermath of the storm. During the visit, Archbishop Schnur also visited Queen of Martyrs Church. The pastor and parishioners were there to greet him and show the extent of damage incurred by the church building and school, both inside and out. An entire corner of the church was missing, though the statue of Mary stood in perfect contrast to the jagged bricks. Inside, insulation was exposed and windows were blown away. Despite the damage and scarcity of available contract workers, parishioners banded together to begin repairs, even anticipating the reopening of the parish school in a few days' time. Although Dayton is beginning the healing process, it is not something that will happen quickly. We learned that long-term recovery can be 2 to 3 years, said Roche. About 15% of that registration number will require long-term support, and that is about 850 families. This is not something that's going to be over in 6 months or a year. Communities are lost forever, added Lehner. We're going to rebuild. Our biggest fear is the reporters have already left. The tornadoes are old news. Eventually, that support is going away. When that dries up, what are we going to do? CCSMV is committed to helping members of the Dayton community heal and rebuild over the coming months and years. For more information about volunteering or financially assisting CCSMV recovery efforts, please contact Mike Lehner at 937-223-7217, extension 1142. Or you can reach him at lehnerm@CSSMV.org. We have some obituaries. Sister Eileen Teresa Breslin, SC. Sister of Charity of Cincinnati, Eileen Teresa Breslin died August 23, 2019, at the age of 103. Sister Eileen Teresa was born Mary Breslin on June 4, 1916, to John Andrew and Martha Breslin in Maysville, Kentucky. She was given the name Eileen Teresa when she became a Sister of Charity 85 years ago. Sister Eileen Teresa earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in English from the College of Mount St. Joseph in 1952 and a Master's in Education from the University of Dayton in 1968. Her more than 45 years of active ministry included 35 years in education, teaching in the intermediate classroom. Sister Eileen Teresa began teaching at Resurrection, Cincinnati in 1937. In 1939, she went to Holy Angels in Sydney, Ohio, from 1939 through 41 and 1969 through 70. Next, it was Holy Family in Cincinnati, 1941 through 43, followed by St. Joseph in Dayton, Ohio, 1943 through 46, St. Gabriel in Glendale, 1946 through 48, Holy Name in Cleveland, 48 through 52, St. Elizabeth in Norwood, 52 through 53, Holy Trinity in Middletown, 53 through 54, Annunciation in Cincinnati, 54 through 57, St. William in Cincinnati, 1957 through 59, and 1963 through 65, Little Flower in Royal Oak, Michigan, 59 through 63, St. Rose in Lima, Ohio, 65 through 67, Corpus Christi in Dayton, 67 through 69, and Holy Redeemer in Kensington, Maryland, 1970 through 1973. Sisters and family greeted visitors in the Heritage Room of the Sister of Charity Mother House on September 5th, followed by the Mass of Christian Burial at 3 p.m. in the Mother House Chapel. Burial was in the Sisters of Charity Cemetery. Memorials can be made in Sister Eileen Teresa Breslin's name to the Sisters of Charity of Cincinnati Retirement Fund, 5900 Delhi Road, Mount St. Joseph, Ohio, 45051. Sister Mary Buckley, Sister of Notre Dame de Namur, Mary Buckley, formerly Mary Ellen, died July 17, 2019 in Cincinnati, Ohio, at the age of 93. A native of Chicago, she was in her 76th year of religious life. Sister Mary taught various math courses, physics, chemistry, biology, general sciences, and religion for 43 years at Mount Notre Dame Academy High School, Cardinal Pacelli School, and Summit Country Day School in Cincinnati, and Notre Dame High School in Hamilton. Sister Mary also taught at an educational program maintained by the Cook County Jail and in the ESI adult education program at Wright College in Chicago. She was the epitome of a lifelong learner as she attended workshops and summer courses, including a two-week space program. Sister Mary was fun-loving, and her sense of humor balanced her apparent seriousness. Memorials on behalf of Sister Mary may be made to the Retirement Fund of the Sisters of Notre Dame, 701 East Columbia Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45215. Sister Mary Milano, Sister of Notre Dame de Namur, Mary Milano, formerly Carmen Teresa, died July 21, 2019 in Cincinnati, Ohio, at the age of 87. A native of Chicago, Illinois, she recently celebrated her 70th year of religious life. Sister Mary enjoyed teaching. For 21 years, she taught every elementary grade between 2nd and 8th and served as principal at schools in Illinois, Ohio, and Arizona. In the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, she served at St. Michael in Sharonville and St. Agnes in Dayton. In Northern Illinois, she served at St. Alexander in Villa Park, St. Robert Bellarmine in Chicago, St. Victor in Calumet City, and St. Rita in Rockford. While studying in Rome, Sister Mary had the privilege of attending the canonization of Sister Julie Billiart in 1969. She also learned of the sisters' new mission in Kenya and went there to teach at a secondary school for girls in Marangoli for 5 years. After training in spiritual direction, she became novice director, then spiritual and retreat director for 26 years. Sister Mary was known for the 150 prayer shawls she knitted, her welcoming smile, and listening patience. Memorials on behalf of Sister Mary may be made to the Retirement Fund of the Sisters of Notre Dame, 701 East Columbia Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45215. And finally, Sister Mary Josetta Wethington, Sister of Charity of Cincinnati. Maria Josetta Wethington died August 17, 2019, at the age of 87. Sister Marie Josetta was born Margaret Ann Wethington on March 5, 1932, to Joseph F. and Etta Wethington in Huntington, West Virginia. She was a Sister of Charity for 67 years. Sister Marie Josetta earned a bachelor's degree in mathematics from the College of Mount St. Joseph in 1960 and a master's in mathematics from the University of Detroit in 1966. Later, Sister earned a master's degree in microbiology from the University of Cincinnati in 1973. She obtained another master's in psychological counseling from Lesley College in Cambridge, Mass. In 1988. Sister Marie Josetta's 50 years of ministry included 23 years in education, 9 in chaplaincy work, and 18 years in counseling in a health care setting. She began serving as an intermediate teacher at Annunciation School in Cincinnati in 1955, followed by ministries at Holy Family in Cincinnati, 1957-59, Little Flower in Royal Oak, Michigan, 1959-63, Seton High in Pueblo, Colorado, 63-67, and Shrine High in Royal Oak, Michigan, to teach biology, 1967-70. Sisters and family members greeted visitors in the Heritage Room of the Sisters of Charity Mother House on August 30th, followed by the mass of Christian burial in the Mother House Chapel. Memorials can be made in Sister Marie Josetta Wethington's name in the Sisters of Charity of Cincinnati Retirement Fund, 5900 Dowley Road, Mount St. Joseph, Ohio, 45051. The Friendly Sons of St. Patrick celebrate Cincinnati's Celtic heritage. By Rebecca Sontag. When the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick Foundation decided to resurrect the on-again, off-again Cincinnati Celtic Festival, retired Army Colonel Dan Shea said to his fellow members, "There's a couple things we have to do. We need to have a grand opening ceremony, and we have to have the mass. We have to have an Irish mass." On both counts and much more, the Friendly Sons delivered. The fabulous Celtic Weekend on the Banks unofficially began August 15th with the Reds hosting Irish Community Night at the Great American Ballpark. Thousands of fans cheered on their teams in this ultimate pep rally preceding the weekend's festivities. While the crowds roared and bats cracked, world-class event manager Cold Iron wrapped up final preparations for the Cincinnati Celtic Festival's opening day. The grand opening ceremony featured a parade, a proclamation from the mayor, Celtic dance, and opening speeches. The Friendly Sons of St. Patrick Glee Club sang the national anthem of the United States, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. And the festival's honorary chairman, Philip Castellini, chief operating officer and president of the Cincinnati Reds, reassured crowds of his Celtic credentials, paying homage to his own Irish ancestry in his welcoming remarks. The weekend of all things Celtic was filled with music, traditional dancing, food, drink, and games. Jigs, slips, and reels filled the air while stiff-armed dancers wearing crowns of frenetic curls dazzled the large crowds at this family-friendly event. There were contests for the reddest hair and most freckles. Who can tell the tallest tale? Who gives the best toast? All of this and more was decided while the Guinness flowed on and on. The haggis toss was for women only. And if you don't know what haggis is, you might not want to ask. Winner beware. As if throwing a sheep's stomach stuffed with sheep organs isn't punishment enough, the victor was honored, or cursed, one might argue, with the responsibility of judging the all-male knobby knees contest. The Celtic Festival's title sponsor, Nicholson's Pub, was one of several establishments that set up shop to feed the hungry festival goers. Revelers consumed untold servings of shepherd's pie, scotch eggs, and other Celtic favorites during the three-day festival. And don't forget the whiskey tent. It wouldn't be at all proper at all to host a steel-tipped dart tournament and not have whiskey available. It wasn't all raucous fun, though. There were quiet moments as well. On the concluding Sunday morning of the festival, under a white canvas tent, Father J. Dennis Jasper celebrated Mass for a crowd of approximately 100 worshipers. The sweltering August morning and wide-awake buzz of the city was kept at bay there in the shade. The Friendly Sons of St. Patrick proclaimed the readings, and all gathered and recited the Our Father in unison. The large Ferris wheel, now a staple of Cincinnati's riverfront, slowly turned while Father Jasper's consecrated the bread and wine. The Kentucky hills, visible across the river, still seemed to sleep. And as the sun burned away the last of the morning mist from the water, the Friendly Sons Glee Club, another Cincinnati staple, sang out in rich and well-rehearsed harmonies. O Lord, my Redeemer, Thou hast done so much for me. O Lord, my Redeemer, all my love I give to Thee. These local Catholic school alum produces award-winning film, The Peanut Butter Falcon. by Alyssa Fisher. For David Thies, that's T-H-I-E-S, the road to the Peanut Butter Falcon began at a local bike shop, Going Mobile Bikes and Boards. This was the name of Thies' bike shop in Hyde Park in the 1990s. There, Thies met a professional cyclist named John Stamstad, who was going to set the world record riding from Canada to Mexico along the Continental Divide. And Thies wanted the filming rights. Part of that project was sold to National Geographic, which led to more work in film, documentaries, commercials, music videos, and then a reality TV show called The Mansion. The bike footage eventually became a film called Into the Divide, which will be released later this year on iTunes. Thies moved to Los Angeles in 2004, and since then, he has worked as a cinematographer, director, and producer. When he first read the script for The Peanut Butter Falcon, he immediately thought of the movie Stand By Me and was struck by the adventure aspects of the story. It was an amazing journey and something I could relate to from my own childhood, said Thies. Growing up in Mount Lookout in the 70s and 80s meant playing with the neighborhood kids, having the freedom to walk to school, and spending afternoons playing baseball. Thies attended Cardinal Pacelli School from 1st through 8th grades and graduated in 1986. He remembers Pacelli as a family-friendly place. Junior high teacher Tom Monger had a special interest in Ohio history, and he took students to see Tecumseh, which Thies still remembers. He also recalled being consistently lucky with bars and bells, pull tabs at Junefest, Christ the King's annual festival. Ask my mom, I was a repeat $25 winner. In August 2019, the Peanut Butter Falcon opened in just 1,000 theaters across the country. Thies said the movie has been a big hit, earning $5.7 million in ticket sales as of September 2019. He attended a local screening at the Marymount Theater in Cincinnati on August 18th and was thrilled by the positive reaction from friends and family with whom he watched the movie. Thies said the movie took about 5 weeks to film in the summer of 2017. It took another 2 years to put the finishing touches on it, particularly the film score. A majority of the scenes were filmed in or near Savannah, Georgia. He said actor Shia LaBeouf arrived a month before filming began to learn how to crab fish. There was a family atmosphere on the set. Shia and Zach developed a genuinely close friendship, he said. When asked what the movie meant to him, Thies said, "It was the chance to do a project I could take home to Mom." He explained that Zach Gottsagen's desire to be a movie star was a major factor. "We wanted to do it for him," he said. Gottsagen plays the movie's lead character, Zach, who has Down syndrome and decides to run away from his care home to pursue his dream of becoming a wrestler. Thies has been working on the movie for 5 years, and there were a lot of little milestones along the way, finishing the script, filming, deciding on the music score, and then releasing it. He said it's been amazing to sit back and watch the world react to it. When you are a producer, you spend a lot of time putting out little fires. It's a matter of taking everything in and making the best educated decision to move forward. Now that the film is out, I'm just grateful that it's a project I can take home to my mother and feel proud about it. Thies' mother, Carol Heilbrun, who lives in Cincinnati, is indeed proud. She said, "The first time I saw the film, 10 minutes in, I forgot David was involved. I was so touched by what I was seeing." She said the on-screen relationship between Gottsagen and LaBeouf was genuine. In fact, I heard an interview with Bruce Dern, and he said that in all the years he's been shooting movies, he has never been in one where there was such a feeling of family on set. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening today. This is all the time we have together this morning or evening. November is soon to be upon us. Thank you all for listening. Please have a blessed week. We'll talk again soon. It's Sue Marks for the Catholic Telegraph. Thank you. Bye-bye.